Bien, nous allons reprendre pour cette deuxième conférence du professeur Nuki Tierney. Je ne vais pas présenter à nouveau Madame Nuki Tierney. Je voudrais simplement rappeler qu'elle mène depuis près de 30 ans maintenant une entreprise très originale d'anthropologie de la culture japonaise comme un ensemble. Et en prenant successivement des symboles caractéristiques qui ont changé de signification au fil du temps. Ça a été le singe. Lors de la dernière conférence, les fleurs de cerisier et leur manipulation politique comme symbole d'identité au Japon. Et cette année, pour cette conférence, c'est une autre plante dont le professeur Nuki Tierney va nous parler, qui est le riz, dont la signification et le symbolisme politique aussi ont varié au fil du temps. Le Japon s'est présenté comme une société agraire fondée sur le riz. Et je voudrais à nouveau souligner le mérite de ce travail qui conjugue une approche ethnographique et une approche historique pour nous dire quelque chose de la totalité d'un pays. Donc cette conférence est « Symbolism and Political Economy, Rice as Self in a Japanese Culture and Society ». Merci, Emiko.
Well, thank you so very much for coming. This is a very busy time of the year, just beginning, and there are so many good lectures going on that I really appreciate your coming here. And it is a great honor to be able to have an opportunity to speak at the Collège de France. I'm especially honored that I was introduced or arranged by Professor Philippe Descola. He is a very internationally known scholar. The last November, when he came to the United States, none other than the University of Chicago had his Beyond Nature and Culture and the Ecology of Others as the primary publication, and for his talk in a very great grand hall, there are over 500 people who came to listen to him. And so his ontological turn was very well introduced, people sitting and then standing and all of that. In my first conference, I introduced two symbols, Japanese cherry blossoms and European roses. I argued that the multiple meanings and aesthetic contributed to how people are unaware that they are not communicating with each other. The insight was from Baudelaire, and then Melon Tendu, and then later Pierre Bourdieu picked up as a méconnaissance. Today's conference, let me present yet another symbol, rice as a symbol of the collective identity of the Japanese self. Rice is a heterosemy that means a symbol with only one meaning, yet the very nature of this single meaning a symbol and equally powerful aesthetic as these two flowers are, although I'm sure that this aesthetic of rice is quite alien for non-rice-eating populations. They have contributed to Melon Tendu, by which all the Japanese were lumped together in the metaphorical equation of rice as self. Rice as self offers two additional themes to deliberate on. That is, we can examine the life cycle, as it were, of the dialectic between political economy and symbolic structure, especially in reference to the importance placed in agriculture in post-agrarian, post-industrial societies today. Additionally, theoretical issues of the quotidian aesthetic presented in my first conference are explored further in this presentation, in which I examine the aesthetic of purity and impurity in practice, which had a long tradition in anthropological scholarship, beginning with Robertson Smith in 1889, followed by Van Genop in 1908. Their argument has centered on the premise that impurity is assigned to structural anomalies in the classificatory schema of the people. These objects and beings that do not fit in the classificatory system and that impurity generates religious and symbolic power. I place them in the context of cultural and political nationalism in which the purity of the self plays a crucial role. And this is so in every nationalism, be it in Japanese or Nazi Germany. We see how these qualities of purity and impurity are assigned to domestic rice and foreign rices in Japan, and how they were then translated into the purity of the self of the dominant social group within Japan, and the impurity of the internal and external others, in other words, social groups who were marginalized within Japan, as well as some of the external others who became marginalized. Let me go over that a little bit more in detail. This is just a scheme of how the self is always defined in reference to the other in the social context of global and or transnational encounters. The rice, of course, was not indigenous to Japan. It was about 400 to 300 BC. When wet rice agriculture was introduced to Japan via Korean Peninsula to Kyushu, which is the southernmost island of Japanese archipelago. The origin of rice cultivation remains controversial, but the most recent archaeological investigation points to the middle Yangtze River. From there, it spread northeastward in three successive waves on the Japanese archipelago. From a social-political perspective, there has been arguably no other historical event as significant for the development of what we now know as the Japanese nation. In southwestern regions, it penetrated. Wet rice agriculture placed the foraging economy of the long Jomon period. Subsequent developments were similar to other parts of the world where foraging economies were replaced by agriculture, which enabled permanent settlements with large populations and property accumulation, eventually leading to the formation of nation states. In Japan, wet rice agriculture ushered in the Yayoi period, in which social classes began to evolve and parts of the country began to unite under landowners. During the subsequent Kofun period, political leaders living in the central and western regions where wet rice agriculture penetrated controlled large territories. One of these regional lords established the Yamato state, whose leaders founded the imperial family. And there's enormously symbolic and otherwise link between rice agriculture and the imperial system. Let me first introduce agrarian cosmology. wet rice agriculture not only became enormously important for the political economy, but it established a remarkable agrarian cosmology, which was later embraced by quote-unquote all Japanese, even though you may be a lumberjack or a fisherman. And so let me start with this agrarian cosmology. Among the beings of the universe that constitute the deities in the Japanese pantheon, rice occupies the central place. The deity of the mountains, the most important in the pantheon, comes down to the villages in the spring and becomes the deity of rice paddies. Fundamental to the meanings assigned to rice in Japanese culture is the belief that each grain had a soul, a view shared by other peoples for whom rice is the staple food. Since the Japanese universe is populated by soul bearers, what is important about the soul of rice is that it is sacred. The 8th century myth histories of Kojiki in Nihongi are replete with references to rice as deities, whose names include words for the grain and stalk. In one version of Kojiki, the sun goddess, the mother of the is the mother of a grain soul whose name bears references to rice stalks. The legendary Jimbu emperor, the so-called first emperor, is the son of the grain soul and the grandson of Amaterasu, the sun goddess, who sends him to the earth in an episode called Descent of the Heavenly Grandson, in order for him to transform a wilderness, that is Japanese archipelago, into a land of rice stalks with a succulent ears of rice and abundant grains of five types. This episode explains why the most important role of the emperors, even after their power was taken away by the shoguns, has been an officiant of the ritual involving the growth of rice. The rice harvest ritual is a cosmic gift exchange in which the original grains given by the guard in the Takamagahara are returned after multiplying the grains and offered in the harvest ritual. So this is an important part of the agrarian cosmology. Now, rice is also the most important food for commensality. Of course, the major effort for rice cultivation is enormously arduous and includes a great deal of cooperation among the farmers in the neighboring areas. This is the way that the people came to identify themselves with a social group whose members help each other at labor-intensive times, such as the planting of seedlings and the harvest. Rice paddies are a spatial symbol of group identity. However, even more significant is that rice cakes, and rice wines have been the most important food for commensality between humans and deities and among humans. For farmers, agricultural rituals have always been the time for relatives residing elsewhere together, dine and drink together. Today, this is often the only occasion when young family members working in cities come back home to the rural areas. The New Year celebration in contemporary Japan is a nationwide ritual during which mirror rice cakes are placed in the alcove as offerings to the deities and then shared among humans, who internalize the sacred power. In other words, eating rice and rice products means that you internalize the sacred power. Rice and rice products are also central to commensal activities in a day-to-day basis as a symbol of commensal act between deceased members of the family, the ancestors, and the living. The daily offering in the family ancestral alcove continues to include cooked white rice. Rice is the only food shared at daily meals and served by the head of the household, usually female, while other dishes are served individually. In the past, in some regions, the wooden spatula used to scoop rice was handed down from a mother to her daughter or daughter-in-law as a symbolic expression of the transfer of the role and the power of the woman head of the house. Rice stands for we, for whatever social group a person belongs. For example, the expression to eat from the same rice cooking pan is a common expression for the close human relationships, emphasizing the strong sense of bonding arising from sharing meals. Those who eat together become we as opposed to they. Commonly used expressions today refer to the opposite situation as to eat cold rice. This is to eat someone else's rice. Rice wine, sake, as you many of you must have experienced, it's something that you are not supposed to pour by yourself. In other words, you have to always be looking at your neighbor's sake cup, and before it gets empty, you have to pour because he or she cannot pour herself. And there's expression, there's nothing lonelier than to pour sake by yourself. So it's a very important item of commensal item. The power of food as a symbol of self-identity derives from two interlocking dimensions. First, each member of the social group consumes the food, which becomes commodities embodied in each individual and operates as a metonym by being part of the self. Second, the members of the group each eat together. Commensality is the basis for the food to become a metaphor for we of the social group. This practice renders foods powerful symbols, not only conceptually, but also, so to speak, at the gut level. Our food versus their food becomes a potent way to express us versus them. The purity of we is the food in the food that is consumed collectively and thus becomes embodied in us. Conversely, their undesirable qualities are embodied through the consumption of other inferior or impure food. Another important dimension, excuse me. Thank you. Another important dimension of rice's evocative power is that rice and rice paddies represent Japanese time and space. In other words, nature, and thus ultimately signify the primordial Japanese self. Although the valorization of the countryside epitomized by in rice paddies began earlier, its systematic development occurred during the Edo period, when Edo became an urban center. This will be shown. Uh, This is the way that with urbanization, rice paddies took on more of the symbolic value of the primordiality. And there are a number of woodblock prints in which travelers are depicted, and the two eternal Japan, that is Mount Fuji in the background, and rice paddies are against travelers who are going to the urban transient center in Japan. And this is the same, the travelers, Mount Fuji again, and then rice paddies. This is the same. And then I will go back to the earlier slides. As you saw in the slides, rice paddies became the primordial space, our Japanese land. At the same time, the rice agriculture represented the past, that is a Japanese history. So it represented both land and time or history. Now I'd like to skip over some of the issues and then go to aesthetics of rice. Now, as I said, that the rice stalks, rice paddies, and the grains of rice all received enormous aesthetic value. Rice stalks have been described in literature as having lustrous golden ripe ears, waving in the autumn wind in the domain of a feudal lord, the symbol of his wealth and political power, literally expressed by the yield of rice in his territory. Rice paddies with green seedlings in crystally clear water are another frequent motif in the in poems, essays, and in woodblock prints. So this is the rice seedling planting. It's a very arduous work. You are planting seedlings in the watered. And that's what the wet rice agriculture means. But then this, for example, the planting of rice became enormously aestheticized in poems and woodblock prints and songs for the children and all of that. We all ascribe to the aesthetic of rice planting without sweat and manure. That was the expression very often we use world over. Not only the plant and the grains, but also cooked rice is beautiful. The most important characteristics of cooked rice are the related qualities of luster, purity, and whiteness. In his Inyeire-san, which is In Praise of Shadows, Tanizaki Junichiro, an important novelist of the 20th century, extols its beauty. Cooked rice in a shining black lacquer rice container placed in the dark is highly aesthetic to look at it, and is most appetizing. When you lift the lid of the lacquer container, you see pure white rice with steam rising from it. Each grain is a pearl. If you are Japanese, you certainly appreciate rice when you look at it this way. So this is, I'm sure, is a bit of an acquired aesthetic for non-rice eating peoples, but that's how the aesthetic for rice has been developed. Even in contemporary Japan, the beautiful whiteness and golden and all of those aesthetic qualities are enormously emphasized, and it is, and the rice is called pure rice, junmai, or white rice, hakumai, or newer labels are koshihikari and sasanishiki, and hikari means light, and nishiki means brocade. It is very interesting that this phenomena of having white rice, in other words, very special not very, but very expensive rice varieties coming from northeastern Japan is in fact a very new phenomenon. Northeastern Japan is where rice agriculture penetrated latest. And American seed industry could not penetrate into Japan because every farmer saved his own grain for the next year. So there was no nationwide seed companies. But then with affluence, so-called the best rice, these a few varieties started to come. And then I think this emphasis on purity is very important because it is the base of cultural and political nationalism, whether a linguistic purity of Quebec or Nazi Germany's political nationalism. Now, so far, what I have presented was more or less the one side, or that is to say that how it penetrated into the political economy of the upper class, eventually becoming central to the imperial family. To see that the rice as the central and most important food item has been thought about as if it was natural. In other words, even historians, most of the Japanese historians are Marxists and they're very liberal, but even they did not come to realize until the end of World War II that in fact we should question how many of the Japanese indeed ate rice as a staple food, and then to what extent others were marginalized and victimized because of this development. And this is not the natural one in a sense. I think in case of cherry blossoms, I did not elaborate the subtle hands of agents in the changing of meanings. But this one, we have more recorded, very articulate record of the agential power. According to Nihon Shuki, in 675, on April 10th, Emperor Temmo issued an ordinance to enforce the performance of two rituals, both trying to promote the rice agriculture, one for the deity of wind and the other for the deity in charge of water. However, 7 days later, he also issued an ordinance prohibiting the eating of five beasts: horses, cows, dogs, chicken, and monkey. And ever since, the official diet of the Japanese have become fish and vegetables. And I say official because there are many so-called getemonogui who use the euphemism of flowers and say, let's go in eat cherry blossoms. Well, that means that they wanted to go to eat horse meat. And let's go to eat peonies, and that means they wanted to eat wild boar. And these restaurants and the butchering are all located across the Sumida River in Tokyo, not everywhere. And in 1942, the Food Control Act was issued, but then even today, up to today, the government has been controlling the production and distribution of food. But interestingly, it's only about rice. A very little concern about other food. And so the scholars are debating what is the other zakkoku, the miscellaneous grains, millet and others that people ate, and then who ate and when they started to eat rice and what have you. Now I will skip the tax. The rice was the form of tax, and that's made it very, very difficult for even the rice producers to become rice consumers, because a great deal of what they produced were taken as a form of tax. Now, skipping to the how this symbolic structure of rice played out in a geopolitical context, I have a term called the external others and internal others. Few groups have lived in isolation from historical flows of peoples and goods. Intensive interaction through trade, warfare, and religion occurred in ancient as well as modern times all over the world. Any encounter with another group, either directly or indirectly through an exchange of cultural artifacts and institutions, prompt people to think about who they are in relation to others. I think I skipped some of the slides, so let me just quickly go back and some of this aesthetic part. In the spring, the deity of the mountains comes down on cherry petals and then becomes the deity of the rice paddy. This is the harvest time. This is the way that rice planting is enormously beautified. And this is another harvest scene. This is the way the woman is making rice cakes. And then we went through this one. And one of the most important, this is a beautiful picture. All of those are reflection of the moon on each of the rice paddies in the valley. And we got. This we already went through by. Now, so what happened is that the state protected rice farmers. Even now, if you laid farms fallow, because we have overproduction all the time, then the farmers are being paid. So it was enormously controlled. But in 1993, during the summer, we had a very cold summer, and we had less rice production than other times. And at that time, Bill Clinton wanted to, this is the contemporary scene, wanted to open a Japanese market. And the rice market was the most important symbolic market for Clinton. So he tried to open Japanese rice market. And then enormous opposition started. And this is the members of the agricultural co-op. And this is how Clinton, with a characteristic nose, became Commodore Perry. And then tried to open the Japan forcefully, whereas Hosokawa at the below, who is one of the descendant of a famous feudal lord, so he's always depicted as a feudal lord, and so Bill Clinton is trying to introduce foreign rices to Japan. And so the Prime Minister Hosokawa is trying to battle with the one on the left is rice, and then on the other hand, economy, and then legal reformation. So this is the a scene of how Hosokawa is battling the rice importation. And you can see how Hosokawa's horse already has bandages on the legs. And the opposition party is saying that we are not going to allow even a partial opening of the rice market. Interesting part was not only the members of the agricultural co-op, but many of the so-called housewives wrote into the newspapers. And they said that, one said that, I was so happy to see a worm in the bag of rice, because that meant that it was not drenched in chemicals. And so when Bill Clinton wanted to say, well, California rice is the same, the Japanese seed, and it's the same taste and all of that, then they started to say, but they do not purify our air, they do not purify our waters, and the rice paddy water very often has all kinds of fish and all of that. And then, so it's not the same, they said. So they protested vigorously against rice importation. And, as far as the politicians go, this was an enormously interesting political performance. Everybody said, this is the last citadel. If we yield, then Americans would force us to have nuclear weapons, and so we just cannot allow Americans to open rice market. Well, the day when the vote was to be cast, everybody changed, and it was nothing. It just passed without any opposition whatsoever. And then the Japanese government wanted to testify how the foreign rice is in fact good. So they went through the system whereby the school children were blindfolded and then given several cooked rice and tell which one is tasty. And the government said that you cannot use the term mazui, distasteful. You have to say najimi ga nai, that means not familiar. So Thai rice became not familiar rice. And then, interestingly, the Japanese woman started to write into the newspapers, oh yes, we do appreciate foreign rices and we can cook them well, but when you look at the recipes, they are all foreign recipes. For example, paella, or the Chinese mixed fried rice, and all of that. So the white rice for the Japanese in the main stayed. Now, when the how the symbolism of rice played out in the global context is that arguably the most important the other for the Japanese was the Chinese, with the enormously developed high civilization of Han and Tang. And so they introduced almost everything from China. Japanese were illiterate, and they introduced a writing system, all the city planning, metallurgy, Buddhism, all of those. But in order to maintain the Japanese identity, they came out with a very clever combination of something that is Chinese would have the preface of Kan, and then for the Japanese, wa, that means Japanese. But I will skip all the details, but to introduce, by the time when the Chinese global power declined, the Japanese started to look up to the West and not look down on the Chinese. And so a very famous liberal novelist has a wonderful novel called Coffin that is minor. And in this son of a well-to-do family, leaves a house and then goes to the coal mine, of course, where he never went. And then he goes through all kinds of hardships. And then when finally white rice came, he was delighted and started to eat, and then he could not pick the rice up. And then miners all laughed. After all, you just don't know the difference between ginmai, the silver rice, and the Chinese rice. The Chinese rice are too dry to pick up with. And so this novelist concludes by saying the lowest type of experience is eating Chinese rice, which they call nankin mai, and being eaten by Chinese bugs. So this is the way that the Japanese high valuation of Chinese civilization, all of that, plummeted down as the power of the West rose. And so the Japanese had to wrestle with the importation of meat for a long time. And that is, there are enormously difficult the process whereby most of the Japanese really did not eat rice, meat. In fact, my grandmother was, house had the first import of French food. So she would cook beautiful French food, including tongue stew and all of that. She will never eat it herself. She know exactly how to make a steak, you know, tasty as well, but she'll never eat it. So anyway, the West arrived, and then we are pressured to combine, include meat. I'm really running out of time. But what it is most important is that in this process of global encounters with the other and the self, it is important to understand how that when you encounter another other, you always have to redefine the self. And this did not necessarily happen in every encounter, but in case of Japan, especially discussing rice agriculture, it is very important to understand that the marginalized groups in Japan are all non-agrarian groups. So it happened. And therefore, when at the end of the 11th century, they started to put into a caste system, they were the ones who engaged in culturally defined dirt, including deaths of animals and humans. So the butchers and the tomb caretakers, and culturally defined. So even tatami makers are because the feet in the body is supposed to be the dirtiest. And the tatami floor is where the feet touches. And so that's culturally defined dirt. And they all engaged in those. Now, when the self must be purified because of the other pressuring to identify yourself, very often there is an urge to purify yourself, and that the most dramatic one was Nazi Germany. As Kenneth Burke talked about, that they, in order to purify Aryan self, they imposed impurity upon the Jews and other groups. In case of Japan, they did so both to two groups. One is the social groups who engaged in culturally defined dirt. The other one, who are not agrarian, and therefore they did not have the claim to land ownership. And so very often, many of them, there were settlements in Edo and other places, but many of them did not have the territorial claim. Now, the other group is the Ainu. And my long career started with studying of the hunter-gatherer called the Ainu. And interestingly, they don't even have a concept of territory. They have a concept of game animals that belong to the social group, but not the territory. But the Ainu were non-literate hunter-gatherers who did not own the land. And by that time, the Japanese have become well-established agrarian population. So the Japanese have adopted the Western social evolutionary scale and then denigrated the Ainu as non-literate and non-agrarian. So the encounter with the West, in fact, in order to elevate the dominant Japanese, created two marginal groups, one the non-agrarian groups, the other one is the Ainu who were settled in southern Sakhalin, whom I studied, Hokkaido and the Kuriles. So let me just skip the, it's already 6 o'clock, I'm awfully sorry. Let me go through the conclusion. An advantage of following its life course, as it were, of the symbolism of rice enables us to examine the complex relationship between symbolic structure and political economy. In most historical periods, strong intervention by the state was exercised so that symbolic meaning and aesthetic of rice were to uphold the political economy. The strength of this symbolism derives in large measures from its aesthetic that may have been created and maintained by the state, and yet it had become naturalized and was translated into the sublimity of the Japanese. The 1993 rice importation event clearly showed that rice as the symbol of the Japanese self had remained as powerfully evocative to the people. The symbolic importance of rice has outlived both the imperial system and agriculture in contemporary Japan, where virtually no full-time farmers remain. Many parallels across societies of the state intervention in agriculture, especially staple food production, on the other hand, their symbolic importance, especially as a symbol of the collective self, on the other hand, call for a careful deliberation on the relationship between the symbolic system and the political economy, neither of which is natural, a natural historic process. Purity has been the most important aesthetic value assigned to rice in the agrarian cosmology. And this value was translated as sublimity of the Japanese. Purity, however, is predicated upon impurity. The dominant Japanese assign the value of purity to themselves by assigning impurity to their internal and external others. The impurity of foreign rice has been a weapon against outsiders even until today. Impurity was assigned to those engaged in work that involves killing of animals. Such scapegoating is a familiar technique whereby dominant social group projects itself in the Hitler's cult of anti-Semitism. The Germans ritually cleanse themselves by loading the burden of their own impurity upon the Jews, according to Kenneth Burke. and major slogan of futurism in Italy, futurism in Italy was hygiene. Ethnic cleansing continues, as in the case of former Yugoslavia. For the purpose of this conference, rice as a symbol, primarily with one meaning, shows an entirely different path with which a symbol creates communicative opacity. The heterosemic symbol of rice, imbued with aesthetic of purity, is transferred to the Japanese as a whole, when in fact the symbol conceals that it represents only the dominant Japanese, those in the upper sectors of agrarian Japan, and excludes the non-agrarian Japanese. Yet most of the Japanese, including those who are excluded in this representation, have not been aware of it. Rice symbolism is a striking example of how communicative opacity takes place. It also shows how the collective identity is a construction whose representation is always partial. Let me just show the rest of the PowerPoints and I will stop. This is still Hosokawa, the rice importation scene. His one move of the fan would decide the stock market both in the States and Japan. Oh, this one is Bill Clinton is saying that how about California rice? And Prime Minister Hosokawa said, well, thank you, but no thank you. Now they were trying to sell in the department stores, and at that time it was very interesting. They named some foreign rices as Mary, M-A-R-Y, Mary the foreign, and then tried to sell. Now we do have hamburgers, but also there are partial transformation of rice burgers. But this agriculture and dairy industries is not confined to Japan. Mussolini's Italy did. Hitler also expounded on agriculture together with industrialization. So did Stalin. But in 1910, when I was here, I shot this. This is the Champs-Élysées, and so you have the agricultural production and meat consumption. And so I think I have been a little disorganized. I'm sorry, my loss of key somehow.